It's nearly 12 o'clock and time for the KMXT Midday Report. Thank you for listening to KMXT. On 100.1 FM, it's your public radio station. We're broadcasting from Kodiak, Alaska, where it is 32 degrees out at the airport right now. They are getting light snow, heavy wind, wind speed steady at 18 from the northwest, gusting to 30. Coming up on the Midday Report, the country's tsunami warning system is in urgent need of an overhaul. Alaska's Board of Fish voted to close some parts of Southeast Alaska to Dungeness crabbing. And an investigation into the mid-air plane crash that killed Representative Gary Knopp and six others has resulted in a set of recommendations. Plus, belugas are back. The white whales have been spotted in Turnagain Arm and in some Kenai Peninsula rivers. Those stories and more after national headlines.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. U.S.-China relations are wading into even more sensitive territory because of Russia's invasion of Ukraine. President Biden is warning China's leader Xi Jinping not to offer direct assistance to Russia's Vladimir Putin. NPR's Frank Ordonez has more on the White House's readout of the leader's lengthy talks this morning.
President Biden and Xi spoke for nearly 2 hours. A senior administration official described the call as direct, substantive, and detailed. They spent most of their time on the video call speaking about the Russian invasion and the potential impacts it could have on U.S.-China relations. The official said Biden made clear that there would be consequences if China provided Russia with material support, but they did not outline what those consequences would be. Asked whether Biden asked Xi to intercede with Putin, the official said the president wasn't really making specific requests of China, but to give his assessment, and that he would let China make its own decisions. Franco Ordonez, NPR News.
Hours before Biden and Xi spoke, a Chinese aircraft carrier sailed through the sensitive Taiwan Strait. In their call today, Biden told Xi that U.S. policy on Taiwan has not changed. Well, the search continues for civilians trapped in a bomb shelter in the southern Ukrainian city of Mariupol. NPR's Liulian Haida has more.
Local officials say up to 1,300 people had been sheltering in Mariupol's drama theater when two bombs fell on the building Wednesday, destroying much of the main structure and caving in the entrance to the bomb shelter underneath. During an online press briefing, Ukraine's Human Rights Commissioner Lyudmila Denisova confirmed that most survived the blasts. Denisova says that more people will die in the city if the rate of Russian shelling doesn't slow down. That's been preventing rescue workers from getting an accurate count of who's trapped and how many people may be dead. Local officials still won't say if anybody died as a direct result of the theater attack. As of Sunday, the city council reported at least 2,300 people had died in the previous 2 weeks. Yulian Haida, NPR News, Lviv, Ukraine.
And now to the U.S., where the pace of home sales slowed a bit last month. NPR's Chris Arnold has details.
After the housing crash, for many years, we just did not build enough homes in the U.S. The National Association of Realtors says that short supply has helped push the median home price up to $357,000. And now with rising interest rates, that's a nasty 1-2 punch for first-time home buyers. Lawrence Yoon is the group's chief economist.
Compared to 1 year ago versus now, if they were to buy a home, their monthly mortgage obligation has risen essentially by 30%, which is a drastic jump for people who want to buy.
Economists say rising rates should stop home prices from rising so quickly going forward as builders try to catch up and build more homes. Chris Arnold, NPR News.
It's NPR.
NPR News is presentada a usted en parte por la Providence Kodiak Island Centro de Asesoramiento. Para una cita o más información, por favor, llama al 907-481-2400.
The country's tsunami warning system is in, quote, urgent need, close quote, of an overhaul. That's according to a report compiled by a panel of 7 tsunami experts and presented to NOAA's Scientific Advisory Board in January. KMXT's Kirsten Dobroth has this report.
The U.S. currently has 2 tsunami warning centers, which operate independently of one another, one in Honolulu, Hawaii, and the other in Palmer, Alaska. Rocky Lopes co-chairs a group of tsunami specialists that's been studying the nation's preparedness.
We're both independently analyzing an event that may produce a tsunami. Sometimes they come up with different results. Sometimes those results are shared between the two centers, and sometimes they're not.
That can lead to confusion, says Lopes. Unifying the country's 2 tsunami warning systems was among 8 recommendations identified by the Tsunami Science and Technology Advisory Panel.
When you visit tsunami.gov, which is the singular website that displays the results of both tsunami warning centers in near real time, the different bulletins, it's hard to really know unless you study it and know which center is issuing which bulletin.
The underwater volcanic eruption in Tonga back in January highlighted that issue and others. Lopes says the most destructive tsunamis are caused by underwater earthquakes. The Tonga eruption generated seismic ripples on the ocean floor, but it wasn't an earthquake, and tsunami warning centers had to depend more heavily on other ocean equipment, like special buoys that watch for tsunami waves, and manually update their systems to get the alert out. In other words, gathering data and issuing a tsunami alert is pretty routine when an earthquake has generated a wave. But it's more complicated when the tsunami is from a non-seismic source. Having 2 separate tsunami centers working on the same problem makes it difficult to efficiently get information out to the public. And if one center went offline, that would be a problem.
Both tsunami warning centers are still functioning quite well. You know, when an event happens, like Tonga, you know, they rose to the occasion and they did everything right. We just have more to go. We have better alerting to do. We have better capability and backup that we need to have implemented that we just don't have quite right now.
Despite some of the shortcomings of the tsunami warning system as a whole, Lopes says Alaska has done a lot to prepare its coastal communities for a disaster. The University of Alaska Fairbanks, for instance, has mapped tsunami inundation zones for the state's entire coastline and out the Aleutian chain. That's been helpful for city officials in Kodiak. The city has been working with UAF for about 3 years to update its inundation maps, and Kodiak's city manager says they plan to hang posters in hotels and public areas around town with the information. Lopes also points to NOAA trainings and communication between coastal communities and the Tsunami Warning Center in Palmer as a strong point. Getting both tsunami warning centers on the same page, though, will streamline the system.
We're really looking forward to it being more unified and having clearer communication for everyone, for emergency managers, for local officials, for media, for the public.
What NOAA will do with the recommendations is unclear for now. Agency officials didn't respond to emails seeking comment. In Kodiak, I'm Kirsten Dobrath.
Alaska's Board of Fisheries this week voted to close some parts of southeast Alaska to Dungeness crabbing for the commercial fleet and sport fishermen. Board members backed proposals from area residents seeking to increase their subsistence catch in these areas. Joe Bicknicki reports.
As they have in other board cycles, southeast residents submitted proposals seeking closed areas near their communities for both commercial and sport Dungeness crabbing. Kurt Whitehead is on the Fish and Game Advisory Committees for Klawak and for Eastern Prince of Wales Island, and those committees proposed some of the closures. For one proposal around Klawak, he explained residents wanted to ensure they could catch crab for subsistence and personal use close to town.
Yeah, this was a real need for the community of Klawak, economically depressed area, small boats. They just wanted to push the commercial operators out just a short ways.
Whitehead explained local residents in that community and others on the eastern side of the island felt like they could no longer catch Dungeness due to the commercial fleet or out-of-state sport anglers. They report local areas where crab are scarce because of that competition and a predation from sea otters as well. The Alaska Department of Fish and Game opposed closing areas and said there's no conservation concern with Dungeness. The commercial fleet had its second highest harvest on record in 2020. Board member Israel Payton of Wasilla said he generally supported closures like these around a community.
I understand. I grew up in a rural community, and I grew up competing with resources as a local stakeholder with, out of state and out of area, out of local residents coming in competing with that. So I understand why communities like a little sanctuary around their area to go harvest. Subsistence is about, harvesting close to your domicile. That's what it's all about, have a sanctuary near your where you live.
The proposal for Kluwak was originally drafted to close the area to the commercial fleet and non-resident sport fishermen, but the board removed the words non-resident on the urging of the Department of Law's Aaron Peterson.
If you were to say, we're just going to allocate everything away from any non-resident fishery, the Department of Law would have serious concerns with that.
It was a unanimous 5-0 vote to close both commercial and sport crabbing in an area around Kluwak. And while they removed the words non-resident, that change leaves the area open to Alaskans only under subsistence or personal use regulations. There are 17 areas already closed to commercial fishing in the region. Commercial fishing industry groups opposed more and backed proposals to reduce some of those exclusion zones. Some of the areas have designations for subsistence use, while others don't, and the board ended up supporting some subsistence sanctuaries, but not others. The board voted down new commercial closures in Kaufman Cove and Kasan Bay, also on Prince of Wales Island, but they approved new prohibited zones for the commercial fleet around Whale Pass and Heidelberg. Mackenzie Mitchell of Fairbanks voted against several of those.
I guess I'm not going to be in support of these proposals. I think that there's an abundance. For me, the arguments presented by the proposer were kind of uncompelling because there was talk about the sea otter population, which is doesn't connect the dots for me for this issue. There was talk about, I quote, fake residents, which by shutting it down to sport fish and commercial fishery, if they're residents, they can still prosecute and subsistence and personal use fisheries. So I'm just having a hard time connecting the dots on this argument.
They voted against reducing a commercial closure zone in Tenneke Inlet, and they voted against wiping a commercial closure near Elfin Cove off of the books. The changes weren't just for commercial crabbers. The board supported closures of sport crabbing around Kaufman Cove and Whale Pass. Board Chair Marit Carlson Van Dort of Anchorage explained her thinking on one sport crabbing change.
You know, I think my intent would be to, provide that opportunity for subsistence and personal use for Alaskan residents. And I think that that's what the intent of the proposal was.
During deliberations, Alaska Department of Fish and Game Sport Fish Division Director Dave Rutz thought many more communities could also be seeking these closed areas.
You know, it could be a slippery slope starting to close areas to sport fishing when there are that many communities, because there's a lot of people out there that are NIMBYs. They don't like people in their backyards, so I just wanted to mention that.
Board members were unanimous in voting down a longer commercial season for Dungeness in the wintertime in Sitka Sound. In Petersburg, I'm Joe Vicknicki.
The investigation into the mid-air plane crash that killed Representative Gary Knopp and six others in Soldotna is ongoing. But the federal board that investigates airplane safety released a set of recommendations based on that incident last month. In particular, the National Transportation Safety Board is asking the Federal Aviation Commission to require pilots to report where they are in the airspace when they're flying within certain radio frequency zones called CTAFs. KDLL's Sabine Pooks has more.
CTAF stands for Common Traffic Advisory Frequency, and they're radio frequencies that pilots can use to communicate with one another while they're in the air.
It's a guide to say, okay, if you're within the boundaries of this particular area, you should be on this frequency, if you have a radio, to be listening for other aircraft so you can help avoid a mid-air collision.
Paul Manelga says pilots have been talking about formalizing CTAF policies for a while. Manelga's a Sterling-based pilot who worked for years with the FAA. And he says in most places in Alaska, reporting on CTAFs is just highly recommended. It's not a requirement. The NTSB wants to change that. It said in its February report that requiring reporting could be a way to prevent other mid-air collisions from happening. There were 14 in Alaska between 2005 and 2020, according to the report, including the accident in Soldotna. The NTSB says it wasn't clear what radio frequencies each plane was using at the time of that crash. Knopf's plane, a Piper Aztec, departed from the Soldotna Airport, which uses one CTAF, 122.5. The other plane, a de Havilland Beaver belonging to High Adventure Air Charters, took off from Longmuir Lake, near Soldotna. There's technically no CTAF associated with the lake, but the report says pilots who fly around Longmuir typically monitor the same channel as the Soldotna Airport. That gray area is an example of how the boundaries between CTAF zones can be blurry. In the airspace above Soldotna, for example, there are five different and overlapping CTAFs, so it's not necessarily a given that pilots near each other will be communicating on the same frequency, if they're even using CTAFs at all. In its report, the NTSB said that could have played a role in the Soldotna crash. The report says, quote, the airplanes departed from different locations, about 4 nautical miles apart, about the same time. They flew on converging flight paths for about 2 minutes until the collision. If a CTAF area had been established for the Soldotna area and a requirement had been in place for pilots to communicate their positions when entering the CTAF, the accident may have been avoided, end quote. Manilga, the Sterling pilot, says pilots in the Soldotna area generally are good about reporting on CTAFs and letting other pilots know that they're in the area.
But those are the local pilots. If you have somebody flying from a different area, they might not necessarily know.
In addition to the suggestion about reporting, the safety board recommends the FAA designate single frequencies so pilots are on the same wavelength. Manilga says that's a conversation pilots have had before.
And there was a move, some of the people in the Experimental Aircraft Association chapter, to actually designate an area around Soldotna bigger than the airport traffic area to have it on 122.5 and to kind of formalize the process where we are actually informally now.
But he says that effort stalled out. As for the reporting requirement, Manilga says he thinks it's a good idea from a pilot's standpoint. He has multiple radios in his own plane and an automatic dependent surveillance broadcast, or ADS-B, a technology that allows aircraft to send and receive three-dimensional data about where other planes are in the airspace. ADS-Bs are also not required by regulators. But Manilga says a mandate might be unenforceable. For example, not all pilots have radios. It's unclear how often pilots should have to announce themselves on the frequency.
It's not as easy as it sounds. It never is.
The FAA says it will review the NTSB's recommendations. In Kenai, I'm Sabine Pooks.
Cook Inlet belugas are spotted in Turnagain Arm and in some Kenai Peninsula rivers every spring. Just as reliable are the volunteers who watch for the whales each May through March. To track their habits and get a glimpse of the endangered creature, in their natural habitat.
To the untrained eye, any flash of movement or ripple of water at the mouth of the Kenai River could be a beluga.
There's something happening over there.
It's a duck, yeah.
Oh.
Not to Kelly Hild of Kisilov. She's a trained beluga monitor, and she knows what to look for when she's searching for whales on the Kenai River and reporting those sightings back to researchers.
So we do a lot of scanning. From this spot, you can see south, so if the whales were coming up from the south, we could see them from there.
Tuesday is the official first day of beluga monitoring on the Kenai. Every spring, trained volunteers like Hild perch on the Kenai and Kisilov Bluffs and along Turnagain Arm to spot the critically endangered whales and record observations for researchers. Those researchers use that data to learn more about what the population is doing and why it isn't rebounding. On Tuesday, visibility on the river is great, minus a streak of sun glare that creates an unforgiving patch of white over a large stretch of the river. Hild, wearing sunglasses and holding a pair of binoculars, hasn't seen any belugas or seals from the park next to the Kenai Senior Center. This is her third season tracking belugas with the Alaska Beluga Monitoring Partnership.
It's kind of addicting once you get out here and you start to kind of see the patterns and the times that they're showing up and things, and then you think you have it, and I'm like, okay, I know who's going to show up tomorrow, and I know. And then they trick you, and they, like, don't show up, or they come, and it's a completely different group, or it's half of the group, or, you know, it's just it's like very mysterious. Like, it's really great that we're all out here and we all have our like theories and our ideas about stuff. But there's so much unknown.
This year, volunteers are making observations even earlier than they usually do, says Teresa Becker, a coordinator for the Alaska Beluga Monitoring Partnership. There have already been several sightings this month, including on a few occasions on the Kenai.
The Kenai River broke up much earlier than it did last year and the year before that. And so the river is open now. The belugas have access, and so they can come in and start looking to see what's in the river, what's coming down the river, and what food is available for right now.
The first observation this year was March 10th, a mom and a calf on the river. Last year, the first beluga sighting was March 25th. Becker tries to look for belugas most days on the Kenai River. Today, she's traveling back into town just in time to start spring monitoring.
I'm very, very excited, and especially to see how they fared over the winter. I mean, they're a critically endangered group, and so we want to make sure that they survived and that they're going to thrive this season.
Researchers know belugas are in the rivers in the spring and that they feed on fish, including hooligan. But beyond that, there's a lot they don't know about the population once it reaches the rivers, says Deborah Bogie-Tobin, a biology professor with Kenai Peninsula College.
Well, that's part of the reason why we're monitoring is because we just don't really know. We think they're going in the river to obviously look for prey, but we don't really know exactly.
She's working with KPC students to collect samples of eDNA, or environmental DNA, tiny bits of genetic material that fish shed when they swim through the river. And they're looking at fish because that's what belugas eat. Scientists say knowing more about the beluga's diet will help them understand how they're sustaining themselves in the off-season.
So we're doing that monthly. And then this month, starting this month, we'll also be conducting the Alaska beluga monitoring as part of our monthly trips.
The official observation season for Turnagain Arm starts a little later, April 1st. Suzanne Steinert runs the nonprofit Beluga Whale Alliance and often does her monitoring from the 20-mile river and near the Mile 95 pullout in Girdwood.
The whales have been kind of in recent years showing up a little bit earlier down there in the middle inlet on the Kenai River than in the upper arm, kind of in larger numbers than in the upper inlet. And so it's not really known exactly why they hit that area first, but there are, you know, in Turnagain Arm anyway, the hooligan run, you know, starts in like April, and that's when we really see them come into the upper inlet.
But this year, monitors have already spotted whales on the arm as early as Saturday. Steinert's going to take a look on Tuesday. Hild, the beluga observer in Kenai, studied animal science in school. She says watching the animals in their natural habitat is really fascinating. She's hardly the only one who thinks so. The Beluga Monitoring Partnership gets volunteers out on the river most days through April. And while today Hild is out on the Kenai Bluff by herself, she'll be joined later this week by other volunteers.
Everybody comes from like really cool backgrounds, and it's not a group of people that I would have met like any other way. And it's just kind of like a little beluga family that comes together. And if you want to come out and volunteer, definitely reach out and come meet us. And the more eyes, the better out here. And it's a really special experience that you can't really get anywhere else because these are our cooking lip belugas. So
you can sign up for a training on the Alaska Beluga Monitoring Partnership website. And the Alaska Wildlife Alliance also has a text alert service that will tell you when there are belugas in the river. Just text beluga to 833-541-0408. We'll have all those links and numbers in the online version of this story at kdll.org. In Kenai, I'm Sabine Pooks.
Insight Daily Radio.
From food to fashion, science to tech talk, or for just plain fun, we've got you covered. From the art of all things, here's Lasana Jeffries.
Although Prohibition officially began on January 16, 1920, the impetus for banning the production, sale, importation, and transportation, though not the consumption of alcohol, had been brewing for decades before. Part of a string of reforms introduced by progressives, Protestants, and other activists to cure all of society's ills. During the progressive movement of the latter half of the 19th and the first part of the 20th centuries, even in places where alcohol remained legal, in certain social circles, openly drinking alcohol was simply not done. To get around this problem, some took to keeping a flask discreetly on their persons, and one convenient place was in the top part of a tall booth, which had been used since time immemorial as a place to stash all kinds of contraband, and has been called a bootleg since the 17th century, and the term was commonly in use during the mid-1800s. By the end of the 1800s, this idea of concealing something illicit like alcohol in one's bootleg led to the term being extended to those who made and or transported alcohol illegally. The first known instances of bootlegging being applied to these individuals started popping up in Kansas within a decade of the state's prohibition laws being established. Soon after the early 1920s, the term was generalized to no longer just reference things related to illegal alcohol, but all manner of items, even bootleg babies, referring to a smuggled baby. By 1930, Variety noted in an article published on April 10th, there is almost as big a market for bootleg disc records as there is for bootlegged books. This term has continued today. Thanks for listening. I'm Lisanna Jeffries. Insight Daily Radio.
The COVID-19 pandemic has created unexpected financial hardship for many Alaskans. Do you need help paying your mortgage? You're not alone. Now there's help. If you own a home, you may be eligible for Alaska Housing Homeowner Relief. The program may help cover mortgage payments, property taxes, utilities, insurance premiums, and homeowner association dues. The last day to apply is Monday, April 4th. Learn more and sign up at alaskahousingrelief.org. That's alaskahousingrelief.org.
This is the Island Messenger, a look at personal messages, the weather, and community announcements.
Today is Friday. It is the 18th day of March, the year 2022. The sun rose today at 8:16. It will set again at 8:20. That will give us 12 hours and 4 minutes of glorious daylight, a gain of 5 minutes compared to yesterday. Looking at our local tides, we have a high tide coming up here on the east side at 3:01 this afternoon. That will be an 8.8-foot tide, followed by a low tide at 9:12 this evening of minus 6-tenths of a foot. Over on the west side, your high tide will occur at 3:35 this afternoon. That will be a 14.8-foot tide in Larsen Bay. That will be followed by a low tide at 9:51 p.m. of minus 1 foot. Mariners, we do have a gale warning through tonight from Marmot Island to Sitkin at Kodiak's east side offshore. North wind to 40 knots today, seas to 15 feet. For tonight, northwest 35, except northeast 30 north of Dangerous Cape, seas to 14 feet. Over in the Shelikof, a small craft advisory through tonight. Northwest 30 today in the Shelikof, seas to 8 feet with freezing spray. For tonight, northwest 30, seas to 8 feet with freezing spray. And for tomorrow, north 20, seas to 5 feet.
Listen for the Island Messenger here on Public Radio KMXT 3 times a day. Monday through Friday at 9 a.m., during the Midday Report at 12:20, and in the evening at 7 o'clock. If you have a community announcement or personal message, including lost and found items or pets, you can call KMXT at 486-3181, fax us at 486-2733, or email psa@kmxt.org.
Hello, Kodiak, and welcome to the March 18th edition of Island Byways. I'm Pam Foreman. Well, it must be time for the vernal equinox. You know, spring. That time of year when Mother Nature loves to play tricks on the people of Kodiak Island. This messy weather is fairly typical of this time of year, though. Regardless of the weather, the vernal or spring equinox happens this Sunday at 7:33 a.m. here in Kodiak. The sun crosses the celestial equator, heading north. We'll have about 12 hours and 14 minutes of daylight on Sunday. Thursday was actually the day we were almost exactly 12 hours of night and 12 hours of day. That's known as the equilux, and it always happens before the spring equinox and after the autumnal equinox. However you want to measure it, we are all likely to be happy to celebrate spring. once we get past the current ugly weather, that is. It's kind of funny. The beach grass was starting to shoot up some new green sprouts this past week, and I actually saw the first little pushky nub shoving its way up through the soil a few days ago. Blueberry and salmonberry bushes were starting to bud, and in some cases, blossom. Oh well, just like the bears and humans, they will likely shiver and shake it all off and go on about their spring activities soon. In the meantime, enjoy the low tides in the mornings or evenings this weekend, and stop to see what's growing along the shoreline and on the rocky cliffs, in spite of the snow. Sometimes something happens to jolt us into a greater appreciation of how precious, delightful, and oh so very short life can be. Rest peacefully, Jay. The world will be less shiny without you in it, and we'll miss you. And that's it for Island Byways this week. Stay safe out there. Thanks for listening.